What if we start with the Alex Rider, like, the, what's the stupid catchphrase that they put on the books right now? Action, adventure, adrenaline.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Disgusting. I think that's a great way to start our episode.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great way to start the episode.
And the world is mine. Hello, hello.
Hi, hello, special agents, and welcome back to the Alex Rider Fancast, Ride or Die. It is me, Andrea.
And me, Nathan.
And today we'll be talking about chapters 3, 4, and 5 of the first Alex Rider book, Stormbreaker. And we're going to be just going through all the chapters, and you don't have to be reading the book. But if you want to read along, that's great. And if you don't, if you've never read the books before, don't worry, we've got you.
Are we wanting to start with a chapter, or is there stuff you wanted to start with to lead?
I was thinking we lead off with a little quick summary of like what happened in chapter 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
So like Alex's uncle's dead,
yeah,
and he
almost died in a
junkyard.
Yeah, yeah. In a squisher.
Almost died in a little squisher.
Yeah, yeah.
And walked away, a little bruised and a little bloody.
Well, yeah, someone shot at him. Yeah, yeah.
Backed away, a little bloody, a little bruisy, and a lot confused. So
That's
where we are starting off. Recap of what has happened so far. We have met our protagonist, Alex Rider. His uncle has died in a car crash, tragically, and Alex went to a junkyard to investigate the car of his uncle and found it riddled with bullets, almost got killed in a crusher, and
almost got squished.
Yeah, and then he escaped a little worse for wear and rode away on his bike.
Well, people were shooting at him, so we have found ourselves in an interesting place to begin Chapter 3. So, Chapter 3 starts with Alex getting a call from the bank that his uncle had worked at called Royal and General. The person on the line is Crawley, and he requests a meeting with Alex in regards to his uncle. Alex agrees to meet with him, and their housekeeper, Jack, asks Alex who called, and Alex lets Jack know that it was the bank. Jack asks if Alex wants her to come with to the bank, and Alex says no. Alex heads out and goes to school, and on his way he begins thinking about Jack and the issues that she will be facing soon. Her visa is expiring, she's not getting paid, she's paying for the bills for the house. Things are not looking super great in the world of Jack right now, so he finds himself hesitating, wondering if what he's doing would be a mistake, or wondering if he'd get hurt. Alex takes a tube to the bank, which is on Liverpool Street. Liverpool is just on the east side of central London, and the bank itself is pretty antique-looking. It has a big Union Jack displayed proudly on the front of the building, roughly 15 floors up. The scene then changes to the bankers, and we find out that Alan Blunt is a part of the group that asked Alex to come to the bank. Upon arriving, Alex meets up with Crawley, and they go up to the 15th floor. On this floor, Crawley takes him up to room 1504, which was the office of Alex's uncle. In the usual Alex fashion, his curiosity piqued, and he asked Crawley if he could go inside the office. Crawley gently refuses. They instead head into room 1505, which is Crawley's office. Crawley's office is just one of those big, boring, regular offices that you see in normal banker-style buildings. As Alex goes into the room, he can see out the window, and he can see a few pretty important things. He can see the flagpole, and he can see a few other things down the street. What were the other things?
He can see Waterloo Station, which is part of central London.
After some brief chatting, Crawley receives a phone call and has to leave. It is from here that Alex decides to check the door to his uncle's office and see that it was, in fact, locked. When Alex first entered Crawley's office, he noticed the flagpole sticking out from the building directly between the two rooms. Between the two rooms, which were Crawley's and his uncle's. Alex opened the window and leaped from the flagpole. He missed by just an inch and caught the flag instead. From here, we find out that Alan Blunt has been watching Alex through cameras and observes Alex's talent. Alex pulls himself up to the flagpole and enters the office of his uncle. Alex begins searching through the drawers and finds many alarming files, with names such as nerve poisons, assassinations, and one even titled Stormbreaker. While looking, the door swings open.
And then we're going to do a little quote from the end of the chapter. "This isn't a bank," Alex said. "Who are you? Was my uncle working for you? Did you kill him?" "So many questions," Crawley muttered, "but I'm afraid we're not authorized to give you the answers." The second man lifted his hand, and Alex saw he was holding a gun. He stood up behind the desk, holding the file as if to protect himself. "No," he began. The man fired. There was no explosion. The gun spat at Alex, and he felt something slam into his heart. His hand opened, and the file tumbled to the ground. Then his legs buckled. The room twisted, and he fell back into nothing.
And that is how Chapter 3 concludes. There are a few moments that we wanted to hit on throughout the chapter that we thought were pretty interesting. I know for myself, as I read through the book, I also listen to the audiobook because they're two different versions, and I really enjoy seeing the discrepancies between the two. One of the things that I noticed was early in the chapter on page 25, if you have the physical copy, there's a moment where they're talking about the reception area of the bank. In one version of the book, it says that this area was quiet and claustrophobic, while in another version, it says that this space was wide and airy. So it's completely changing the scenery, and the quiet and claustrophobic one is the most recent iteration of this space.
Yeah, and then after that, when Crawley comes out of the elevator into the lobby to collect Alex, Crawley is like, "Oh, Alex, did you just get back from school?" And instead of replying, Alex just stands up and is like, "I am wearing a school uniform, sir." So it's just another sweet little moment of Alex's personality showing. You know, he's a quiet kid, but he's also pretty
sassy.
He's also pretty sassy. And something that I wanted to mention that we didn't talk about was Alex and Coke. So when Crawley brings Alex to his office, he offers Alex a drink, and Alex wants Coke because it is his favorite drink. Throughout the series, whenever Alex is offered a drink, he will have a Coke. So this is the first time Alex ever drinks Coke in the books, which is so stupid, but I wanted to talk about it.
It's funny because it's not even Coke he receives from Crawley.
Yeah, Crawley gives him, like, off-brand Coke, and Alex hates it. And the second Crawley leaves the room, he, like, dumps it into a potted plant, which is so savage.
Yeah.
So when Alex is jumping from the window to the flagpole, we get a little cutscene of Blunt and Jones, and so Blunt says, quote, "I told you, the boy's extraordinary." "The boy's quite mad," the woman retorted. "Well, maybe that's what we need. You're just going to sit here and watch him kill himself? I'm going to sit here and hope he survives," end quote. I think that's interesting because it kind of shows, it's a very quick moment of characterization for Blunt and Jones. So we know that Blunt doesn't really care about Alex's life, and we know that Jones is a little bit more concerned about Alex's safety than Blunt is. We know that Blunt doesn't care if Alex dies or not, even in this kind of test that they're doing for him. So I thought it was interesting.
The last little comment that we had on this chapter was that this is the first time in the book that the title of the book gets name-dropped. It is where you see Stormbreaker mixed in with all of these files, so that we know that it is something, like, alarming and something that it was incredibly important, because it's mixed in with things like nerve poisons, new methods of concealment and dissemination, assassinations, and then you got stuff like Stormbreaker mixed in. So It's kind of interesting and alludes to the tone of the book.
Money, PayPal yourself. Come on. Come on.
Okay, so I'll be taking care of chapter 4, and chapter 4 is called So What Do You Say? And I'm going to start with quoting the first sentence. Quote, Alex opened his eyes, so he was still alive. That was a nice surprise. End quote. Alex, I like this little moment of Alex's characterization because it shows his sour demeanor. And I was thinking about it and I realized Alex is technically a Gen Z kid, I think, because... Mm-hmm. He was born in 97 or 95, so yeah. He would fall under Gen Z, which explains his his style of comedy quite well. But anyway, Alex realizes that he's in some sort of Elizabethan house in the country, and he knows this because he can't hear traffic and he can also see trees. So I think it's interesting just mentioning Alex's attention to detail and his ability to kind of gather information about where he is and what's going on shows that he has a quick mind. And Alex notices that he's in some pajamas, which he obviously wasn't wearing, which means someone undressed him while he was sleeping. And this is not the first time it's going to be happening in the book, so I thought I would mention it. I don't know why, but Horowitz likes to do this to Alex. He thinks it's like a fun trope or something.
At least he woke up in these like nice silky PJs. Like they weren't low quality, they were fancy.
Yeah, I mean, Alex is going to wake up in some places that are pretty nasty later on, so.
But he gets to enjoy this moment at least.
At least this one isn't too bad. And Alex has apparently lost like a day and a half because it's now 12 o'clock of the next day. Alex is kind of walking around the room and he goes into the closet and he realizes that a lot of his clothes from Chelsea are there, and it is extremely alarming. Alex puts on like Gap and Night clothes, which like poor choice in style, my friend. And then a nurse comes and takes Alex to meet with Mr. Blunt for lunch, and when they get to the table, it is set for 3, and it is Alex Blunt and a woman who is sucking on a peppermint. Alex is reasonably upset about being shot at, and Blunt is very dismissive about it, saying that it was, quote, the easiest way to get Alex there.
Mm-hmm.
Blunt also introduces Alex to Miss Jones, his right-hand woman, and they start to eat a lunch of Cahiers d'Ingenue, sorry for mispronouncing it, and we get a little nugget of information that Alex might be familiar with French because he knows that it is roast lamb. Blunt explains that the Royal and General Bank is a cover for the Special Operations Division of MI6, and Blunt is the chief executive, and Ian Ryder was a spy for MI6. And I have another little quote here from the book. Alex couldn't help smiling. You mean, like James Bond? Similar, although we didn't go in for the numbers. 00 and all the rest of it. Your uncle was a field agent, highly trained, and very courageous. End quote. Alex starts connecting the dots that Ian would come back from trips all over the place, and he would be with injuries. He would be like bruised up a little bit. So I think it's interesting that they mention James Bond because we all know that this is supposed to be like a James Bond sort of series. Young James Bond is kind of how it was marketed. And then Anthony Horowitz is actually like one of the official writers for James Bond novels now. So it's just kind of interesting how
he wrote
that
his
all
own
kind
destiny.
Of works together. Yeah, he literally like manifested that for himself, which is really cool.
Gotta respect it, honestly.
Yeah. So I'm going to read a little bit about Ian dying, which is fun. Okay, so Blunt is talking and he says, quote, Ian Ryder's luck ran out on his last mission. He had been working undercover here in England, in Cornwall, and was driving back to London to make a report when he was killed. So, Alex asks about Stryker and Son, and Jones tells him that they are a real company, they're not like a shell or anything, and they just clean up after MI6 with like money under the table. Jones is the head of operations and gave Ian his last assignment. She says she is sorry, but Alex is bitter and doesn't think that she sounds very sorry. And there's another little moment that I wanted to highlight, so I'll be quoting from the book. And this is Alex talking first and then Miss Jones. Quote, "Do you know who killed him?" "Yes." "Are you going to tell me?" "No, not now." "Why not?" "Because you don't need to know. Not at this stage." End quote. Alex thinks about what he knows and asks about where he is. And Jones says that they are in a training center, and Alex doesn't really care. He just wants to get out of there, and he offers to sign the Official Secrets Act, which is basically something that says he won't talk about what's going
on. Yeah, it's like a non-disclosure agreement, but very fancy and very...
Yeah, it's with the government. But Blunt admits that they need Alex's help with a guy named Herod Sale. Alex is familiar with the name. He knows the guy does stuff with computers and horses, and he's from...
Cairo.
Cairo. Yeah. Oh my god. And we get a little backstory on Herod Sale from Blunt. So Sale was from a very poor family in Cairo, and he saved the lives of some affluent tourists when he pushed them out of the way of a piano that fell out of a window. And these people basically adopted him and put him into school in Britain, where he winded up being at the same school as the current Prime Minister. And then we hear about the computers that he's making, which are the Stormbreakers. Alex recognizes the name of the Stormbreakers from the files in Ian's office and from PC Review Magazine, because Alex is such a giant nerd and he reads PC Review Magazines. Mm-hmm. I just love all these like little nuggets of Alex's nerdiness that...
It's strange because he has so much depth in so many different ways. Like, he's incredibly athletic and he's a super nerd, and also like all of these just, and he's super sassy, like all these little facets that don't seem like they would always go together create this like pretty interesting character in Alex.
I was, as I've been reading these books, I've been like, oh no, you know how everyone talks about characters that they like, you know how you're like apparently an amalgamation of like characters that you read about? Mm-hmm. I've been reading these books and I'm like, oh my god, I'm Alex Ryder.
Yeah.
I'm Alex Ryder, but not in a good way. And anyway, just funny things that I think about sometimes. We also get another like little tidbit about Alex knowing things about computers, which is he knows that, quote, "It's an integrated circuit on a sphere of silicon about 1 millimeter in diameter. It's 90% cheaper to produce than an ordinary chip because the whole thing is sealed in, so you don't need clean rooms for production." And Alex is talking about the Stormbreaker, and Blunt is like shocked that Alex knows so much, and he's like, "It must be my age."
Mm-hmm.
So Alex is really just like getting in those digs when he can.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but we get back to Blunt talking about Sale Enterprises and that they are announcing distributions of these Stormbreaker computers to every secondary school in England as a thank you to his second home. And Sale said, quote, "I wish to make a gesture, something that will never be forgotten, to express my true feelings toward your country," which is so on the nose.
Because,
yep, like, we all know that he's going to be the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, really, really on the nose. And this fool is also going to have these computers turn on April 1st, which is so...
Just, the thing
really interesting writing choices being made by Horowitz right now.
There's a lot of things in here that just feel very like cartoon-esque, like the piano falling, for example. It's What are the odds that there's not only that a piano that actually falls out of a window, but that there's a rich, wealthy family underneath it?
Yeah, you can tell it's very, like, villain of the week-esque. Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially at the beginning of the Alex Rider books.
Yeah.
And, things about the Stormbreaker. The computers are being made in Port Talon, Cornwall, which is, way far west. It's, a coastal section of Britain. And it's in the countryside, also. So Miss Jones starts, she takes over the conversation, and she says, MI6 thinks Sale is too good to be true. Quote, we've been looking into his business and dealings, which means they're really nosy. And Ian was sent to Cornwall to keep an eye on Sale under the cover of a security man. And Ian was there for 3 weeks and found Sale, quote, short-tempered and unpleasant. But they got a message from Ian saying that he had discovered something about the Stormbreakers and that they couldn't leave the plants. And Ian had actually left Cornwall and was going to London to report when he was ambushed. And Alex just kind of sits there, stunned as he's, like, listening to all of this. Blunt says that this is proof that something is happening, and they need to know what is going on before the computers are sent to ship in three weeks on March 31st. Quote, that's why it's essential for us to send someone to continue where your uncle left off. And that means Alex. They can't send in another agent because Sale will be expecting it, so they have to trick him and send in a child. And lucky for them, there was a computer magazine that ran a competition to have a boy or girl meet Sale and test the Stormbreaker. And a 14-year-old boy named Felix Lester won. And they think Alex looks enough like him to go in Lester's place in about 2 weeks. And Alex doesn't want to, and Blunt says that Alex is extremely brave and resourceful, and they suggest that he works for them, go to Sale Enterprise, and Blunt says that he's just going to be reporting back, so he won't be in any danger, and it's 3 weeks. And a chance to serve his country. And Alex is instantly like, no, this is stupid. We're not doing this. Oh, and I wanted to, also from the quote when Alex is saying it's a dumb idea, he says he doesn't want to be a spy and he also wants to play soccer. He's just a kid and,
he wants to have his own life.
Yeah. So we're going to read, one of the more important scenes from the chapter. So I will be reading the narration, and I will be reading Blunt's lines and Jones's lines, and Nathan...
I'll be reading Alex's lines.
Okay, great. So, here we go. That's a pity, Blunt said. His tone of voice hadn't changed, but there was a heavy, dead quality to the words. There was something different about him. Throughout the meal, he had been polite. Not friendly, but at least human. In an instant, that had disappeared. Alex thought of a toilet chain being pulled. The human part of him had just been flushed away. We better move on to discuss your future, he continued. Like it or not, Alex, the Royal in General is now your legal guardian.
I thought you said the Royal in General didn't exist.
Blunt ignored him. Ian has, of course, left the house and his money to you. However, he left it in trust until you are 21. And we control that trust. So there will, I'm afraid, have to be some changes. The American girl who lives with you.
Jack?
Miss Starbright. Her visa's expired. She'll be returned to America. We propose to put the house on the market. Unfortunately, you have no relatives who will be prepared to look after you. So I'm afraid that also means you have to leave Brooklyn. You'll be sent to an institution. There's one I know just outside Birmingham. The St. Elizabeth in Sourbridge. Not a very pleasant place, but... I'm afraid there's no alternative.
You're blackmailing me!
Alex exclaimed. Not at all.
But if I agreed to do what you asked...
Blunt exchanged a glance at Miss Jones. Help us, and we'll help you, she said. End scene. So, that's kind of like the biggest moment in the chapter is how they force Alex into working for them. Because after that, Alex... obviously agrees. But it's a lot. It's really intense. It's horrible that they blackmail him into working for them by threatening to take away basically everything that Alex knows.
It's a bit weird that his uncle left that in the will so that Alex didn't have a choice if he wanted to take on this life or not. It's just like, he's just there. He has to do it.
Yeah. And I have my, like, tinfoil hat theory about about Ian Ryder in general as a character, because there's just nothing about him in the books. So a lot of fan interpretation. There are a couple interpretations of Ian Ryder, but the biggest question is, like, was he training Alex to be a spy, and how much did MI6 plan to use Alex, either as a child soldier or in the future? And that's something I can get into a lot later when we're a little more familiar with the books and with Blunt. But yeah, so that was the biggest part of the book. Alex agrees to work with them, and he knows there's nothing to do. And Jones tells him that his training is going to start at once, and Alex is like, yeah, okay, I don't really have much of a choice in, you know, in what's going on. And we're going to close out the chapter with the quote from the last three sentences. Quote, he glanced at the slices of cold lamb on his plate. Dead meat. Suddenly he knew how it felt. End quote. Okay, so a moment I forgot to mention is on April 1st, the ceremony where they, like, turn on the computers is supposed to be in the Science Museum in London. Quote, the Prime Minister is going to press the button that will bring all the computers online, the whole lot of them. And this is top secret, by the way. Mr. Sale is to be rewarded with British citizenship, which will be something he has always wanted. End quote.
All right.
So, we're now on chapter 5, which is called 00 Nothing, and we begin in media res. Alex is on day 10 of training in the Brecken Beacons, I think is how you pronounce it.
It's so pretty.
With the Special Air Service. So, Brecken Beacons is in Wales, and it is a national park, and it is gorgeous. You should look up pictures of this place if you can. It is absolutely gorgeous. But Alex can't see anything because it is raining so hard. He's trudging through horrible weather, and it's raining, he's exhausted, and the days are starting to blend in together. And just to set the stage a little bit, I have a quote from the beginning. Quote, It was almost 5 o'clock in the evening, although it could have been 5 o'clock in the morning. The sky had barely changed at all throughout the day. It was gray, cold, unforgiving. The rain was still falling, a thin drizzle that traveled horizontally in the wind. Soaking through his supposedly waterproof clothing, mixing with his sweat and his dirt, chilling him to the bone. So just a really pleasant outing for Alex right now.
He's absolutely on top of the world.
Yeah. And Alex is making his way to the last rendezvous point, and he is totally lost because of how heavy it is because of how heavy the rain is. Alex is wearing a 22-pound backpack. He has a skinned knee from tripping. He has bruises on his shoulder from the backpack, and he has a gash on his neck, and he's wearing camo gear that is too big because they had nothing in his size. Alex is running on caffeine and glucose tablets, and if he doesn't get to the RV point, he will be binned, which means he will be thrown out of the course. And he mentions that they would like that. And they is referring to the SAS team that Alex was put into. And they are the team that Alex was sent to train with immediately after his lunch with Blunt and with Jones. The site that Alex is on, it has 9 huts, 4 people in each, and 1 hut that's a kitchen and 1 that's like a bathroom. And the first person Alex meets when he is there is the training sergeant, and this guy is a little worried because Alex is 14 and a lot angry because he's supposed to give 14 weeks of training in 12 days, and he says it is, quote, suicidal. And Alex is like, I didn't ask to be here, and the sergeant does not care for his sass and immediately just tears into Alex. Alex is assigned K unit, which is a team of 4 men, and Alex is the 5th. So an extra bed was put into their hut, and each member has their own special skills, but Alex has none.
And they were just brutal to him in getting into like as soon as he entered this unit. They start with, you'll join K unit. We don't use names. I have no name. You have no name. If anyone asks what you're doing, you tell them nothing. Some of the men may be hard on you. Some of them may resent you being here. That's too bad. You'll just have to live with it. And there's something else you need to know. I can't make allowances for you. I can make allowances for you. You're a man, or you're a boy, not a man. But if you complain, you'll be binned. If you cry, you'll be binned. If you can't keep up, you'll be binned. Between you and me, boy, this is a mistake, and I want to bin you.
Yeah, I think it's nice to see immediately that the sergeant has a little bit of sympathy for Alex.
Yeah.
As much as he can give him, anyway. And I also have a quote introducing the K unit. Quote, they were all in their mid-20s, spread out over their bunks in companionable silence. 2 of them were smoking. 1 was dismantling and reassembling his gun, a 9mm Browning high-power pistol. Each of them had been given a code name, Wolf, Fox, Eagle, and Snake. From now on, Alex would be known as Cub. The leader, Wolf, was the one with the gun. He was short and muscular with square shoulders and black, close-cropped hair. He had a handsome face, made slightly uneven by his nose, which had been broken at some point in the past. End quote. So we met K-Unit. Hooray! And Wolf is the pseudo-leaner of K-Unit and is pretty upset about Alex being there. He asks Alex if Special Forces have brought him there, and Alex says he can't tell. And then Wolf calls Alex 00 Nothing to mock him. And then the rest of the unit starts calling Alex 00 Nothing. Alex always trails behind the unit So he's kind of part of it, but not really. And while he's in training, he does map reading, radio communication, first aid, and hand-to-hand combat, which Alex gets his butt handed to him. And yes. There's also an assault course that Alex has to go through a few times, and he manages to cut his time down to 17 minutes, which is respectable because Wolf can only do it in 12, and Wolf is twice his age. Yes. Wolf is... let's see. The only member of K-Unit that is actively hostile towards Alex. He taunts him, he humiliates him, and during their training, he actually tries to kick Alex when they're, like, crawling around. But the biggest thing that happens is an incident in the Kill House, which is a fake embassy that was set up for hostage release and negotiation training. We also get the first mention of Alex being salty that he does not have a gun. Quote, all four men were armed. Alex himself didn't take part because someone somewhere had decided he shouldn't carry a gun, end quote. Thus begins the Alex not having a gun saga in this book series. There's only one point, I think, that Alex has a gun and uses it, and it's at the end, and it's really important. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
End of this book specifically.
Oh, no, at the end of the series.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, in Scorpio Rising, yeah. So, on this particular situation that Alex is thinking about, the team is going through the house, and their exit point is a window, and Snake neutralizes the alarm. There is also a tripwire that is running the length of the room that Fox and Eagle are trying to neutralize before Wolf tells them to forget about it, and they start exiting through the window. First Snake, then Fox, then Eagle. And Alex is supposed to be the last person to leave, but something happens. And this is where we start our first scene for the chapter. Quote, just as he had reached the exit, he found Wolf blocking his way. Tough luck, 00 Nothing, Wolf said. His voice was soft, almost kind. The next thing Alex knew, the heel of Wolf's palm had rammed into his chest, pushing him back with an astonishing force. Taken by surprise, he lost his balance and fell, remembered the tripwire, and tried to twist his body to avoid it, but it was hopeless. His flailing left hand caught the wire. He actually felt it against his wrist. He hit the floor, pulling the wire with him. The tripwire activated a stun grenade, a small device filled with a mixture of magnesium powder and mercury fulminate. The blast didn't just deafen Alex, it shuddered right through him as if trying to rip out his heart. The light from the ignited mercury burned for full 5 seconds. It was so blinding that even closing his eyes made no difference. Alex lay there with his face against a hard wooden floor, his hands scrabbling against his head, unable to move, waiting for it to end. But even then, it wasn't over. When the flare finally died down, it was as if all the light in the room had burned out with it. Alex stumbled to his feet, unable to see or hear, not even sure anymore where he was. He felt sick to his stomach. The room swayed around him. The heavy smell of chemicals hung in the air. 10 minutes later, he staggered out into the room. Out into the open. Wolf was waiting for him with the others, his face blank. He had slipped out before Alex hit the ground. End quote. So he sees K-Unit and the training officer, who tears into Alex for ruining the exercise, and Alex has the chance to snitch about what really happened, but Alex chooses to take full responsibility, and the sergeant decides to punish the entire unit with a 30-mile hike with no rations, no lighters, and no fires. The hike starts at 6 a.m., and that is where we meet Alex at the beginning of the chapter again. So we're back in the present, and Alex rounds a corner, and he, quote, sees the sergeant, and then, quote, he had just lit a cigarette, and Alex watched him slide the matches back into his pocket. Seeing him there brought back the shame and the anger of the day before, and at the same time sapped the last of his strength. Suddenly, Alex had enough of Blunt, Miss Jones, Wolf, the whole stupid thing. With a final effort, he stumbled forward the last 100 yards and came to a halt. End quote. He's at a bit of a breaking point. The sergeant tells Alex that he made it in 11 hours and 5 minutes, but the others were there 3 hours ago, and Alex has to also climb up a 200 to 300 foot wall, and at that point, Alex is done. Quote, he had never attempted anything as difficult as this, not on his own, not when he was so tired. I can't, he said. In the end, the two words came out easily. I didn't hear that, the sergeant said. I can't do it, sir. Can't isn't a word we use around here. I don't care. I've had enough. I've just had... Alex's voice cracked. He didn't trust himself to go on. End quote. And we see a surprising amount of sympathy from the sergeant, who extends a courtesy to Alex and tells him that he knows Wolf pushed Alex into the tripwire because of the CCTVs that were in the killing house. And he asks Alex if he wants to make a complaint against Wolf, and Alex declines. The sergeant also tells Alex that the rock face isn't that bad and that there are some cold rations waiting for him up there. Alex walks past the sergeant and is so tired that he trips and brushes against the sergeant to steady himself. And Alex gets to the camp 20 minutes later, and Snake has his only line of dialogue, which is, quote, I didn't think you would make it, end quote. And Wolf is also trying to start a fire with Flint, and we get our last scene for the chapter. Quote, Wolf struck the stones again and again. The others watched, their faces glum. Alex held out the box of matches that he had pickpocketed from the sergeant as he had pretended to stumble at the foot of the rock face. These might help, he said. He threw the matches down, then went into his tent. End quote.
I'm so proud of how smart Alex is here.
Yeah, so like, there are a couple of talents that Alex has. So the first one is pickpocketing, and the other one is lockpicking. Those are like his real talents that he has. And then he also like speaks a bunch of languages, so...
So it's not just French.
No, he speaks French, Spanish, and German. So.
Oh, man. Yeah. A man of so many talents.
He is. It's because he traveled a lot with Ian. So. Mm-hmm.
I mean, and only being 14 years old and being fluent in that many languages, or at least knowing that many languages.
Yeah.
Impressive.
It is. And in Devil in the Deep Blue Sea, Alex learns, he learns Russian, and he also learns Arabic, because it would be beneficial.
Chambers to other worlds I went. all my life, all my life. Be my life, on me, I am a satellite, and I can't get back without you.
So, that concludes the three chapters that we were going to go over today. So, moving forward, what does this mean and how?
Yeah, I think for the next, we'll probably read three chapters for the next session. And, I mean, where we're at right now is Alex has been blackmailed by his government. He's been shipped off to God knows where, and
he's just received training,
you know, with a bunch of adults.
Mm-hmm.
Which is something we're going to see a lot of in the books, is Alex being the only kid in the adult world.
Yeah. And even then, with this chapter, not only is he with a lot of adults, there's even one there that's actively trying to sabotage his entire being here.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate we don't... This is basically the only time that we'll see K-Unit, because... they're so prevalent in fan fiction. We kind of took K-Unit and brought life into it because, like I said, Snake only gets one line of dialogue, and I don't think... I think Fox might be mentioned later, but I don't think Eagle really gets anything. And it's honestly hard for me to remember what is canon about K-Unit and what is... Fanon for the K-Unit, because so much has been written about them that I kind of just assume that what is canon in the fandom is what Horowitz actually wrote, which generally isn't the case.
One thing I found really interesting about this most recent chapter is that Alex was able to keep up really well, because even when they gave him like extensions on things to allow for his age, like he made it to the base in 11 hours and 5 minutes or something like that. When they gave him 12 hours, so he was almost an hour ahead of schedule. And even though it was 3 hours slower than everyone else, it was still like he was outperforming his age brackets. Like,
Yeah, and you also have to consider Alex, they don't mention it, I think, in this book, but Alex is really small for his age. He's 14, but if I remember correctly, he's like less than 5'5", and he's less than 110 pounds, I think. So he's just a really small kid.
Yeah.
And he's got, like, a 55-pound backpack on or something.
Yeah.
So it's more than half of his weight that he's trudging around in. So it's really impressive when you think of that. But Alex is also, you know, he plays soccer, he does karate, he's a pretty active kid, so I'm not surprised that he would be capable of this kind of physical performance.
The only thing they mentioned about size so far in here,
Fit of the clothes.
Yeah. Which, because if I was trying to imagine Alex with everything they talked about, you would imagine him as, like, sort of the late teen super athletic build, like that really lean, like, runner build. But that's just not the case.
Yeah, so. No, he's just a real shrimpo right now.
Yeah. He is lean and, you know, very fit. The fact that he can knock someone out with a karate kick is impressive for his stature. And the with his stature stuff, that helps a lot with his sort of stealthy, sneaky stuff.
Yeah, that's part of why they're capitalizing on Alex right now, is because of his size and appearance is what they're trying to do. And keep wanting to talk about Devil in the Deep Blue Sea. I can't!
One of these days.
One of these days I'll be able to talk about it, but now is not the time.
Mm-hmm.
Also, because I'm a giant nerd, I actually have a chapter. I'm so sorry I didn't get this sent to you. I have a chapter that was removed from Stormbreaker that took place during this training arc, and it is when, I think, the Green Boots come to Brecken Beacons to perform resistance to interrogation on all of the units, which now includes Alex. And it's a funky read. It's really wild. And yeah, it gives you an idea of how dark Horwitz actually wanted to go with the story, but was not allowed to.
Yeah, he chose YA instead of
adult. Which, oh my god, speaking of, I don't know where it is. I've looked for it and I can't find it. But I know that there is a piece of text that Horowitz released where he had written about Alex as like a 20-year-old or something. And it was super, super cool. And he was thinking about writing a book where Alex is like in his adult years, and he thought that there just wouldn't be enough interesting. It was either him or his publishing company thought there wouldn't be enough interest in like an aged up Alex Rider book.
Yeah.
So he kind of dropped the idea, but so many people that I know really, really want it. So.
Well.
That's just a fun fact.
If there's anything else you want to add, do so now. Otherwise, maybe starting the next episode on the removed chapter could be good.
That's a good idea.
Because then we could hit on the chapter, because it would fit very perfectly right in here.
It would, yeah.
And it would then allow us to lead into the rest of the book.
Yeah. I mean, if we want to cover that, I think we definitely could and should.
I think we should. I think it would be really interesting, because you want to add something to the show that most people can't get access to, and that would be exclusive removed chapters. Could be a really good way to
thank
do
you,
that.
Thank you, Pongnosis, for sending it to me.
Yes.
She published it on the Discord server, so.
Fantastic. So, I believe that's going to be it for us.
Our special code word for the episode is going to be Fern. So, if you see me or Nathan, and you have listened to our show, please give us the code word Fern so we know.
Yes, you will get a big ol' high five and maybe a surprise. So, anywho, I appreciate everyone for coming out, and hopefully we will see you all soon.
Bye.
Goodbye, everyone. You're the whole world, and the world is mine.